Civilian Defense Council of City College presents today the third of a series of radio discussions on the general subject, The Democracies Will Win. The talk this afternoon deals with the tools of victory, manpower and machine power. And the speaker is Professor Bernhard Osterlenk of the Department of Economics, who analyzed in a recent book the importance of skill and technology. Professor Osterlenk.
What makes the president's breathtaking defense production program less fantastic in its magnitude is the breathtaking achievement towards defense during 1941, a year when we were not at war, when we were still manufacturing automobiles and building skyscrapers, when the country stood before the world cataclysm confused, frustrated, and impotent, beleaguered by isolationists, fifth columnists, racialists, defeatists, and other divisive influences. It seemed that a mighty nation had lost its power to act. But the political impotence could not check the industrial preparation for the coming conflict. The 1941 achievements for defense are stupendous, measured by any yardstick. They give an inkling of what bad news is in store for Honorable Hirohito and Herr Hitler in 1942 and 43. Now that the country has decided to substitute for its leisurely pace an all-out defense program. The 1941 defense front, besides including an arsenal, extended the protective arm of the United States through lease-lend activity to the United Nations, hampered the Axis powers economically by the blacklist and the freezing orders, accumulated stockpiles of strategic materials, promoted the ever-normal granary for food and fiber, created new defense activities in Latin American countries through the loans of the export-import banks and along a wide front prepared for the conflict. But let us first glance at the arsenal. In terms of funds appropriated and amounts contracted, the country must now digest figures of unparalleled magnitude. Almost $115 billion had been appropriated by the end of January against a total cost of World War No. 1, including loans to the Allies, of about $27 billion. From July 1940 to December 1941, direct disbursements of the Treasury on all types of armaments have been $14.5 billion. To this must be added the loans and grants made through the RFC, the Meriton Commission, and other government agencies, and also the defense expenditures of foreign governments in the United States. These total closely to $20 billion for expenditures already made. In January 1942, defense expenditures exceeded $2 billion just for 1 month, and within a few months, we expect expenditures to reach the tremendous amount of $1 billion a week. Translating dollars into defense materials, potential and actual, we again come across figures which are breathtaking in their magnitude. The 1937 steel production of 50 million tons has been stepped up to 86 million tons during 1941. By itself, more than the combined production capacity of all lands now under Axis control. According to the Iron Age, this United States steel production contrasts with the maximum of all of the Axis countries in Europe and Japan of 49 million tons, the United States total of 86 million tons, plus that of Russia, United Kingdom, Canada, and other allied countries, makes 128.9 million tons. New highs have been reached in the production of electric power, coal, oil, copper, zinc, lead, and aluminum. Not only has domestic production of these raw materials been stepped up sharply, but in spite of shipping difficulties, imports of 10 essential raw materials increased from 2 million tons in 1938 to 6.5 million tons in 1941. An increase of 200%. The percentage increases in imports of some of the raw materials are bauxite, 195%, chrome, 240%, manganese, 136%, mica, 88%, copper, 205%, Cork, 103%. Graphite, 639%. Rubber, 145%. Tin, 279%. And wools, 853%. These are the figures for all commodities. When we seek to convert them into actual units produced, the comparative figures again reveal our potential productive power. Take the production mostly in the public mind, that of military aircraft production. In 1937, we produced 949 aircrafts. In 1941, 20,000. The 20-fold increase in production in 5 years only shows the quantity increase. It does not show the astounding increase in quality, the larger, swifter, higher flying, and better equipment of these planes. On the basis of these increases, another 3-fold increase in 1942 is entirely probable, now that production of automobiles and other civilian equipment is severely limited. In January, a Treasury leaflet reported that more than 2,000 military aircraft planes are being produced monthly. Shipbuilding on an unprecedented scale is underway. The Office of Facts and Figures reports that 968 naval ships are now under construction in 11 government shipyards and 110 private shipyards. Of these 968, a total of 135 combat ships, 500 auxiliaries, and small ships were completed in 1941. The American strength in major combat ships as of October 1941 totaled 344. But there are in the building an additional 347. A new navy, doubling the present navy, is in the building. The tempo of production of auxiliary merchant ships reached one completed ship each day during the last month of 1941 and is expected to be double that by the end of 1942. This rate of production is the more remarkable when it is remembered that from 1922 to 1935, not a single cargo vessel was built in the United States for overseas or foreign trade. Vying with the aircraft industry in unparalleled increase in production is the tool industry. Normal tool production of 25,000 units was increased to about 200,000 units, an 800% increase. These figures do not reveal the improvement in speed, power, efficiency, and precision. The average 1941 machine tool is probably three times as productive as the average machine tool of 1939. The industry employed 37,000 workers in 1939 and more than 100,000 in 1941. It must be re-emphasized that these production figures are for 1941, when we were at least technically at peace, and when the war effort was merely a byproduct of business as usual. During 1941, we produced for civilian demand almost 5 million automobile units, and new building construction reached the highest figure since 1929, to give only two illustrations. But in 1942, automobile production is to be reduced to about 500,000 units for defense needs, one-tenth of the 1941 production. And all government budgets, such as the capital budget for New York State or New York City, have eliminated new building construction. Private industry is also contracting production for all civilian needs and is increasingly applying its huge productive facilities to war needs. With this change in aim, the proposed production program of President Roosevelt, fantastic in its magnitude, seems entirely probable and feasible. That program provides this year 60,000 planes, next year 125,000 planes. This year, 45,000 tanks. Next year, 75,000 tanks. This year, 20,000 anti-aircraft guns. Next year, 35,000 anti-aircraft guns. This year, 8 million tons of merchant shipping. Next year, 10 million tons. This is a production program that outproduces many times the capacity of the world. The Office of Facts and Figures asserts that in 1942 alone, we will produce as many tanks and planes as Hitler did in all the years before 1939, when he was preparing for world conquest. Our labor power behind a military front will prove adequate. German military authorities estimate that modern warfare demands 10 workers behind every soldier to supply munitions, tanks, airplanes, food, clothing, and other goods to the military arm as well to the civil population. From the standpoint of sheer numbers, a 5 million men army will require 50 million workers. Not only is such a labor force available, but it should be remembered that American workers have at their disposal power equipment of over 2,000 kilowatt hours per worker. The German worker has about 700 kilowatt hours. The Italian worker about 250, and the Japanese about 200. In brief, it is not an idle boast to say that an American worker is twice as productive as the German worker and 4 to 5 times as productive as the Italian or Japanese worker. This applies not merely to our mass production industrial workers, but also to agricultural producers who are using power equipment in farm production. The addition in power enables American workers to increase enormously the mining of ore, to smelt it, refine it, roll it, process and fabricate more equipment, and to transport and move more goods. It is well that we know our strength. We need not fear any foe now that we are united in an all-out effort to which every American is to make his contribution. Our gigantic productive capacity will place at the disposal of our fighting forces modern and adequate equipment to conserve life and manpower and assure victory. Lack of unity of purpose, overconfidence that slows down an all-out effort, and panicky fear engendered by defeatists might endanger victory. Another fear that gnaws at the vitals of American defense is the fear of domestic food and consumer goods shortages. If that fear is translated into hoarding, there is danger of inflation and disaster. Let it be said at the outset that the national defense will demand that we forego the use of many things to which we are accustomed. However, it is also true that unless a hoarding movement gets underway, there will be adequate supplies for all essential needs to promote health and good living. Farmers and producers of consumer goods, like those producing military goods, have stepped up production enormously. The 1941 farm production was the largest on record. Essential foods and fibers in unprecedented quantity are stored away in the ever-normal granary. Cheese, milk, pork, beef, and poultry production in 1941 were from 5% to 20% above the preceding year, and in all cases are at record high levels. Fruits and vegetable production are at the highest level in the history of the country. Here again, nothing but panicky fear of shortages, panicky buying and hoarding, and waste are the factors that may lead to inflation and disastrous impediments of the victory effort.
Professor Bernhard Osterlenk of the Department of Economics at City College has just concluded a talk on the tools of victory, the third in a series entitled The Democracies Will Win, and given under the auspices of the Civilian Defense Council of City College. The professor and his colleagues who take part in the broadcasts have kindly consented to answer questions. So if you have any questions, please address them to this station or to Civilian Defense Council, City College, 139th Street and Convent Avenue, New York. Tune in again next Thursday at 4:45 when Professor Milton Offutt will speak on naval and air power. This is the Municipal Broadcasting System. Control.